From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
The build-out of Alligator Alcatraz is on hold, at least for the time being.
You don't put 5,000 people in the middle of the Everglades. No one has ever suggested that that was a good idea.
Also this week, it seems Texas and California aren't the only states thinking about redrawing congressional district maps.
We're malapportioned right now as a country, I think, because of the migration. But the state of Florida, I think, for sure.
We'll also delve into Florida's ramped up battle against sickle cell disease. And we'll find out why some colorful street art in Florida may soon be painted over. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end of week wrap up of top stories from Tallahassee. Siding with environmental groups, a U.S. district judge this week temporarily blocked state and federal officials from further expansion of the immigrant detention center in the Everglades. Judge Kathleen Williams' temporary restraining order put on hold for 2 weeks additional construction or infrastructure, paving or installation of new lighting at the remote facility known as Alligator Alcatraz. That's according to groups that are challenging the site. The 2 week temporary restraining order will halt additional construction as litigation over the environmental group's request for a preliminary injunction proceeds. Tanya Galone is an attorney with Earth Justice, a plaintiff in the case.
There was no environmental review done. We know that the impacts are happening. And that if the review had been done, this site would not have been chosen. You don't put 5,000 people in the middle of the Everglades. No one has ever suggested that that was a good idea.
State officials this summer quickly erected the detention center as part of the DeSantis administration's efforts to support President Donald Trump's mass deportation of undocumented immigrants. The site has a capacity of 3,000 people and could be built out to house up to 4,000 detainees. The state says it will appeal the ruling. There's been so much sturm und drang going on about what's happening in the state of Texas with redistricting right now that perhaps we have kind of lost sight of the fact that here in Florida, we may be looking at the same kind of situation. And so Tristan Wood joins us right now to give us the latest on how that is developing in our very own Sunshine State, since the Florida House is now taking a first step towards congressional redistricting. House Speaker Daniel Perez, he's asking for legislative volunteers to step up for some kind of congressional redistricting committee. So what does all this mean?
So in a letter to lawmakers on Thursday, Perez says the group will look into redrawing the maps after a recent Florida Supreme Court decision claimed the state's constitutional amendment known as fair districts may be illegal. Now, the court was looking at maps championed by Governor Ron DeSantis back when maps were redrawn earlier this decade. And his maps remove the two minority access seats. Those are essentially for a minority group under the Fair Districts constitutional amendment. Certain minority groups would have to be drawn into a district so they could select a candidate of their choice, essentially making them a majority in that district. Now, people sued the state after Ron's maps removed those districts, complaining they violated that constitutional amendment. But the state Supreme Court, who mostly consists of DeSantis appointees, say that that constitutional amendment may constitute racial gerrymandering, which is illegal federally. Now, Perez says that this state Supreme Court decision means all Florida's districts, state and federal, should be reconsidered. But he believes they only have time to review congressional seats immediately, hence why he made this committee to only look after congressional seats.
Okay, that's great, but are there any other reasons why this is going on right now?
National outlets have been covering that there is federal pressure from the Trump administration for states controlled by Republicans to redraw their maps ahead of the 2026 midterms. Texas is undergoing a redistricting process that would redraw maps to give more seats to Republicans. California is considering their own process in response. Now, there has been speculation for weeks that Florida would undergo a similar process. On social media, Florida's announcement of this process has been cheered by Republicans, but largely panned by Democrats.
Okay, but does this have buy-in from other state leaders right now, Tristan?
So Governor Ron DeSantis has already said he would be in favor at looking at redistricting over the past several weeks.
We're malapportioned right now as a country, I think, because of the migration. But the state of Florida, I think, for sure. So I think there's ample justification to do it.
However, he has clashed with Perez this previous session over other issues, so it's possible they tussle again over what these maps will look like. And so far, Senate President Ben Albritton has been silent about the process.
Which means plenty more developments likely yet to come, and we'll be checking back with you to find out precisely what they are. Tristan Wood with us on Capitol Report. Thanks, Tristan.
Thanks, Tom.
Saying the case has significant implications for home construction and the economy, home builders and the septic system industry this week backed the Florida Department of Environmental Protection in its appeal of a federal judge's decision that required additional steps to protect manatees in the northern Indian River Lagoon. The Florida Home Builders Association, the Florida On-Site Wastewater Association, and the National On-Site Wastewater Recycling Association earlier this week urged the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals to overturn a decision by U.S. District Judge Carlos Mendoza that included placing a moratorium on constructing and installing septic tanks around the northern Indian River Lagoon. That's primarily in Brevard County. Mendoza sided with the environmental group Bear Warriors United, which argued that sewage discharges into the lagoon led to the demise of seagrass. That's a key food source for manatees and resulted in starvation deaths and other harm to the threatened species. But attorneys for the home builders and the septic system industry groups requested approval to file a brief at the Atlanta-based appeals and disputed the judge's conclusions that the department had violated the Endangered Species Act. Coming up on Capitol Report, pill mills used to be a big problem in Florida. Now it appears that problem may be emerging again.
It could happen that someone is an excessive user or purchaser of these drugs, and it escapes the notice of law enforcement. But that's the way that the legislature designed the prescription drug monitoring program.
More state money is on its way to battling sickle cell disease in Florida.
When you understand more about the disease, you understand just how painful it can be for that patient population.
Despite protests, it looks like some colorful street art that flies in the face of official state policy in Florida may be disappearing.
It's a free country and everybody should have the chance to express who they are without fear of being judged.
And we'll be among the first to hear the sound of a stingray eating lunch, as well as learning why these unique sea creatures are perhaps more important than we realized.
I think that there is potential for eagle rays to be sort of like a sentinel species.
Federal prosecutors say a South Florida doctor has prescribed millions of opioid pills to clients he never saw in person. They say it was part of a larger scheme involving co-conspirators and Broward County's pharmacies illegally selling prescription drugs for large amounts of cash. WLRN's Jake Shore has been looking into this case and what it says about Florida's years-long fight against so-called pill mills. He spoke with WLRN's Helen Acevedo.
Jake, pill mills are not really a new story in South Florida. They were a huge problem over a decade ago, right?
You're absolutely right, especially in Palm Beach and Broward counties. These were doctors prescribing opioids to patients for pain out of unregulated clinics with few questions asked. Between 2008 and 2009, a new pain clinic opened up in Broward and Palm Beach every 3 days on average, Law enforcement found that South Florida's clinics fueled opioid deaths and drug crime across the country. The state eventually stepped in and passed two laws. One required the Florida Department of Health to oversee pain clinics, and another established a database tracking prescriptions. And in just a few years, clinics in the state were cut in half, and state officials counted those laws as major achievements.
So what made you want to look into this specific case?
So I noticed the case of Dr. Sergey Margulian buried in a Department of Justice press release. He's a pain management doctor with clinics in Davie and Hialeah. A federal grand jury indicted him in June, alleging he prescribed roughly 2.9 million pills of oxycodone from those clinics between 2021 and 2024 to clients he never saw in person. The case was tied to patient recruiters and pharmacists operating in Broward County. In one instance, a customer came in to one of the Broward pharmacies regularly, purchased prescriptions for multiple people, and paid $800 in cash per bottle of pills. Margulian has pleaded not guilty, and so have other defendants. Margulian and one pharmacist still have active medical licenses. Given the success of Florida's pill mill laws, how did this doctor and these pharmacists allegedly distribute millions of pills for years with nobody stepping in? And why was this still happening?
So you're asking these questions. What did you find?
One of the first things I did was I tried to figure out how Florida's laws interacted with this case. The first legislation that put guardrails on pain clinics told doctors they had to register with the state and submit to a yearly inspection. So I asked the health department for those inspection reports. During that same period, federal prosecutors said Margulian was prescribing pills for profit. His clinics were actually passing with flying colors on state inspections. These were inspections part of a law intended to stop pill mills. I sent the inspections to an experienced drug investigator, Lisa Michelhaney. She's the chief operating officer of the National Association of Drug Diversion Investigators. She's also a former Broward sheriff's deputy who had a role encouraging the state to pass laws to fight pill mills in the early 2010s.
What I have found over the years is that the patient files, the signage, the patient contract, I mean, everything is templated and they follow what they know needs to be there.
Michelhaney also said these cases are very difficult to go after for local law enforcement. Federal privacy laws make it a procedural burden for police to look at health records to prove their case. They have to get a court subpoena to look at them.
Okay, well, what about that other law, the prescription database?
It's known as the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, or PDMP. Lots of states have them, and they provide a streamlined way to keep records on prescription drugs. In theory, a doctor is supposed to check that database before prescribing opioids to a patient to make sure that they're not doctor shopping. It's also used by law enforcement as a record to go after patients abusing the system and even doctors or pharmacists. So I couldn't figure out why that system wouldn't have caught Dr. Margulian or the alleged co-conspirators from the start. So I went to an expert, former top prosecutor for Palm Beach County, Dave Ehrenberg, to ask him about this case.
There's privacy restrictions. And so it could happen that someone is an excessive user or purchaser of these drugs, and it escapes the notice of law enforcement. But that's the way that the legislature designed the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. They wanted to be somewhat of a passive system. So it's up to the doctor or the pharmacist to alert the authorities that something is amiss. And then it's possible that the state could see some irregularities. But someone has to say something.
He said he had always wanted a more active PDMP that alerted police or the medical board proactively when prescription irregularities arose.
And what did the state health department say in response to your reporting?
I requested interviews with the head of PDMP in the state, and I even sent them a list of questions. All I got back was a very short statement. In part, it said, quote, dispensers are required to report specific information each time controlled substance dispensing occurs. However, the PDMP does not have regulatory authority over licensees, and they do not conduct investigations into possible violations. They said investigations are handled by the agency's Medical Quality Assurance Division. From there, the state's Board of Medicine or Board of Pharmacy would take over.
That was WLRN's Jake Shore talking about Florida pill mills with Helen Acevedo. Sickle cell disease is a significant concern in Florida, with the number of patients in the state far outpacing the national average. Now, new state funding could help advance research and ensure more patients have access to care. Margie Menzel reports.
Camille Turner Bragdon says she didn't know that she and her husband both carried the sickle cell trait until their son started showing symptoms.
We didn't find out until he started having swelling in his hands at about 6 months old.
Turner Bragdon is a mental health counselor at Tallahassee State College. Her son, Cash Bragdon, is now 25. He loves music and sports and has sickle cell disease.
This causes patients to have excruciating pain in the joints, and it can be anywhere throughout the body.
Having the trait means a person has one sickle cell gene and one normal one. Having the disease means a person has two sickle cell genes, one from each parent. The disease alters the shape of a person's red blood cells,
which makes them like a half moon shaped, and so they're pointed on both ends, which makes them hard to move through the blood vessels.
In addition to being extremely painful, sickle cell can also be deadly, cutting a person's life expectancy by as much as 20 years, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Researchers have been working to find new treatments, and Camille Turner Bragdon says her son Cash was recently able to get a bone marrow transplant.
They're doing other experiments now with, you know, gene therapy, but doing the bone marrow transplant is the only known cure for sickle cell disease.
Cash received the transplant from his brother, who doesn't have the disease or the trait. Cash says the transplant has significantly improved his quality of life.
So I have a different kind of energy, and I've been just trying to stay active and keep my body on the same level as my energy. Yeah.
Mother and son say more research is needed to help others live longer, better lives with the disease. And this year, Florida lawmakers approved funds to help make that happen. Tampa Democratic Representative Fentress Driscoll helped champion the cause. Driscoll says she has relatives who carry the trait and family friends who have the disease.
When you understand more about the disease, you understand just how painful it can be for that patient population. You understand that they don't always get the care that they need because people don't always understand the disease. Sometimes they're treated like drug addicts because they present with symptoms of pain and they go for pain relief.
The latest state budget allocates nearly $4 million to support research and care. That includes encouraging autopsies for those who die from the disease to get the data to guide further medical developments. Money will also pay for vans at 15 treatment centers across the state to help ensure patients can get access to care. Driscoll says next session she hopes to push for higher rates of reimbursement for providers of Medicaid services, especially specialty care. I'm Margie Menzel.
A proposed federal rule could help Florida citrus growers by lowering the required level of sugar in pasteurized orange juice a half percent to 10%. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration proposal would make it easier for Florida growers to use more of their citrus and rely less on imported juice. Florida Senator Ashley Moody filed legislation this year known as the Defending Domestic Orange Juice Production Act. She says this proposal mirrors that bill.
Consumers will not see any difference in terms of taste or quality. What it will do is allow growers here in Florida to compete, to offer oranges for orange juice at a competitive price, and that always works in favor of consumers.
The proposed rule must undergo a 90-day public comment period before it can be finalized. Florida's citrus industry has seen a 90% decline in production over the past three decades, and growers have dealt with citrus greening and damaging hurricanes in recent years. rainbow-painted crosswalks and Black Lives Matter street art installations could be a thing of the past in Florida. WUSF's Megan Bowman explains how some groups are responding to a new order from the Florida Department of Transportation.
St. Petersburg is home to an iconic LGBTQ+ art installation at 25th Street and Central Avenue, the Progressive Pride Street Mural, and it recently celebrated its 5th anniversary. But the stretch of concrete painted with broad, parallel stripes of vibrant colors might not be there much longer. The artwork symbolizes the birth of one of the largest pride organizations in the Southeast, St. Pete Pride. President Dr. Byron Green Kalish says it's a reminder Pride doesn't happen only in June.
It is a part of our history. It is a part of our current. It is a part of our future. It is a reminder that queer people are here all year long.
He says volunteers worked with the city to make sure everything was done properly. But a new memo from FDOT bans art on travel lanes, paved shoulders, intersections, crosswalks, or sidewalks to make roads safer for drivers and pedestrians. U.S. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy sent a letter in early July to all state governors, giving them 60 days to identify safety improvements. On X, he posted, quote, "Taxpayers expect their dollars to fund safe streets, not rainbow crosswalks." Green Kalish says no tax money went to St. Pete's Pride installation.
The upkeep, the volunteers that come out to engage with it, the paint that we purchase, the sweat equity we pay to have the roads shut down while we do it, all of that comes from donations from community members.
Now, even if the installations were already approved, they might be erased. Green Kalish says government efforts to get rid of street art will only mobilize people. Residents who live near the mural also want it to stay, like Carlos Rodriguez.
Because it shows you how people feel, it makes the community happy, and it turns all us into one.
Others, like Scott Neff, say removing it would only increase distrust in the government.
It just represents people's, you know, identity. And, you know, it's a free country and everybody should have the chance to express who they are without fear of being judged or criticized for it.
If local governments do not remove installations like rainbow crosswalks and Black Lives Matter street murals, the state can withhold funding for essential projects like pothole repairs, road construction, or bridge maintenance. Green Kalish says he wants to stand up for all street art, not just rainbow crosswalks. But he recognizes the financial impact of keeping the installations.
How do we both navigate the pushback of the erasure of marginalized communities while also fighting, knowing that those communities are also going to be the most impacted?
But the FDOT memo is not clear on whether temporary art like chalk will be included in the ban. Artist Justin Lucci started the Global Love Project in St. Pete about 4 years ago. Every Sunday morning, Lucci went to the same spot off Central Avenue and 11th Street to draw messages of love, hope, and unity with chalk. Since then, it's grown a lot. Lucci says he's drawn alongside more than 10,000 other community members, and his spot is now a designated tourist attraction on Google Maps. Lucci says the chalk art and street murals are representations of love, and reading the memo shook him.
I felt more inspired to lean in more to chalk and just the permission for people to openly express together.
He says things are changing for the Global Love Project, not because of the memo, but because there's more of a need to express love.
You can't stop artists from creating. It is who we are as beings.
Officials in St. Petersburg say they're discussing whether any local art qualifies for exemption. They haven't painted over anything yet, but other cities have. Boynton Beach covered a rainbow street mural in July. Tampa will soon start removing all street art, including the Back the Blue mural outside the downtown police station. Sarasota will remove multiple installations, including the LGBTQ+ focused Pride Walk. I'm Megan Bowman in Tampa.
Luck was with a disease-riddled green sea turtle when she was rescued earlier this year from a fishing line. Now, in good health, she's helping provide information on her species, as WGCU's Emma Rodriguez reports.
A 35-pound green sea turtle named Haven spent the last 6 months in rehab at the Turtle Hospital in Marathon. She was found wrapped in fishing line and covered in fibropapilloma tumors. After her treatment, the 8-year-old endangered green sea turtle got her chance to return to the sea Friday in this year's Sea Turtle Conservancy's Tour de Turtles race. Haven was equipped with a small satellite transmitter attached by a special epoxy to the top of her carapace. Sea Turtle Conservancy Communications Coordinator Lexi Beach explains why the transmitter is important.
Every time she surfaces, that satellite transmitter will send a ping, and it will update either on the Tour de Turtles website or our STC Sea Turtle Tracker app.
Participants in the race are typically nesting female adults that migrate several thousand miles over the course of 3 months from August to October.
We're especially interested to see how her migration pattern and her behaviors might differ from the wild adult nesting turtles that we're tracking. So we're really interested to see what she does this year.
The satellite monitor Journey gives researchers valuable data about the migratory patterns of sea turtles while raising awareness about the threats they face. I'm Emma Rodriguez.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, marine researchers from Florida Atlantic University have revealed a new perspective on marine life, specifically the perspective from often elusive stingrays. WLRN's Sophia Zoran has more.
That is the seldom heard sound of an eagle ray eating. It's a sound that might not have been possible to collect without the help of tags developed by FAU researchers. Matt Ajamian is a professor at Florida Atlantic University's Harbor Branch.
Because the animals themselves, particularly the eagle rays, have very smooth skin and are pretty otherwise elusive, we had to get kind of creative with the attachment.
The result of this creativity is the longest documented external tag on a ray, about 60 hours. Rays have been so difficult to monitor in the past because they don't have prominent dorsal fins. And many rays are what they call ultra smooth, making it difficult to secure cameras. So the new system uses silicone suction cups and straps attached to small openings near stingrays' eyes. With the tags, researchers were able to identify key behaviors of a white-spotted eagle ray, like foraging, burrowing, and eating habits. That was the sound of a ray munching on a clam. Cecilia Hampton is a PhD student. Her work on the team deals with interactions between hard-shelled prey and their predators, like rays.
I think that there is potential for eagle rays to be sort of like a sentinel species.
Understanding the behaviors of batoids, which includes all rays and even sawfish, will help experts understand their interactions with their environment. Ajamian, who's been studying rays for almost 20 years, tells WLRN this is the first time he's seen and heard a ray eating in the wild.
This isn't exactly plug and play. There's a lot of things that have to go right in the field. You know, essentially, we say the stars have to align.
Hampton says this research could be used to further restoration efforts, like restoring the queen conch in the Caribbean. I'm Sophia Serran in Miami.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Jake Shore, Helen Acevedo, Megan Bowman, Emma Rodriguez, and Sophia Zoran. Technical support for Capital Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week, online and on air, for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.